From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in many places in Rochester, but let's choose this one. In the Beechwood neighborhood, our city, like almost every other city, has no shortage of corner stores. We're looking at one store in particular on Webster Avenue that for years is the image of a typically rundown corner store. In 2011, it was purchased by Northeast Area Development with an ambitious goal. Take what is known as an unhealthy place and convert it to a hub for healthy food and a safe place to gather. Beechwood residents had nothing like it at the time. 2 years later, it reopened as the Freedom Market, a project supported by a number of local foundations, Food Link, and more. The junk food largely replaced by fresh fruits and vegetables. Wegmans built a new kitchen in the nearby Freedom School Cafe, where some of the food sold in the Freedom Store is prepared. This is what you might call a small thing that's a big thing. A single store, but a symbol of change, of a neighborhood revitalization effort. This hour, we're looking at various efforts around our city to revitalize different neighborhoods. What works? What are the efforts that are underway now? How do you get the community to buy in? What about affordable housing? What about gentrification? My guests for the hour include the following. Louis Aponte is here. He's from JOSANA, the president of Charles House Neighbors in Action. And Louis, it's nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Also here is Eugenio Marlin, the vice president in charge of the Ibero-American Development Corporation. Eugenio, nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Scott Benjamin's here, the president of the Charles Settlement House as well. Scott, nice to see you.
Thanks, Evan.
Well, let's start with a very basic question on what we mean by neighborhood revitalization. Because, you know, for example, Eugenio, I already had listeners this morning saying you gotta talk about gentrification. It's not just full-scale development all the time. You have to consider stakeholders. You have to consider people who've lived there for years, even if it means in poverty. What does revitalization mean to you?
Well, it means bringing back a neighborhood to what it used to be. So you revitalize it. You bring more life to the neighborhood from all aspects, and not only from the housing perspective, but also from the economic perspective, and which is something that we are committed to do in the neighborhood where we operate.
I shared a kind of a success story to start, but where do you, if you want to show me one success story of an example, even if it's a small section of a neighborhood, but you point to one that stands out to you that says, hey, we are making progress.
Yes, Ibero-American Development Corporation has set itself to work within the boundaries of Upper Falls and Norton Street, Clinton Avenue, and the river. And we have been there for a long time, relatively speaking. And through the times that we've been there, we have organized the neighbors from the first thing we did was look at the assets of the neighborhood mm-hmm. and build on the assets. We made sure that the relationship between the police department and the community were amended. There were a lot of misconceptions. The neighbors didn't think the police cared. The police didn't think the neighbors cared until they started talking and they found that they have had a lot in common. It's just the strategy of how to deal with each other that wasn't working. We took a neighborhood that was a thriving neighborhood in the past. Back in the 70s, there were a lot of industries around Clinton Avenue. There was, people worked and played in the same neighborhood, and they walked to their jobs. And that has all changed. And with it, the neighborhood got run down. So we decided that we were going to become committed to the neighborhood. And we have done a lot. We have brought stakeholders into the neighborhood, and we have transformed the neighborhood in a manner that is going in the right direction.
Okay. Scott Benjamin is president of the Charles Settlement House. For the audience members who aren't familiar, first of all, tell us what Charles Settlement is and what the mission is.
Well, sure. Charles Settlement House is a nearly 100-year-old human service agency, and what it really boils down to is that we're trying to improve the lives of the people in our service area. So Charles House, being place-based, serves the northwest quadrant of the city. We have programs from youth development, like after school and summer and teen programs, all the way to a senior center and family services that are basic needs and so on. And then a piece that's very important to us as well, while it's mostly driven by volunteers and less staff, but we are involved in community building and neighborhood asset improvement and so on. And that's what really got us involved in some of the things that are happening now in the Josana neighborhood, which has historically been our home base of Charles Settlement House.
Josana stands for?
J. Orchard Street Area Neighborhood, with the A being from when there was an association called Josana.
Okay, very good. And so what's one small example of a success story that you would point to so far?
Well, I think a big piece of what we've worked on is creating with the city a plan for overall what should happen there. And we can talk more about everything from the housing to the school and so on as we go forward. But to me, an example of real success is residents who, on their own, with very little support from our agency, now have an annual block club picnic in August. And the last couple of years, there have been over 600 people on what used to be a vacant lot at Broad and Smith Streets, right across from the soccer stadium, and to see 600 people organize the event almost entirely by themselves, get the donations, prepare everything, and not have a single problem. That's success. That visualizes success more than the housing and all the other things that we're working on.
Yeah, well said. Luis Aponte, we'll start the same kind of question with you. How do you define what neighborhood revitalization means in this city?
In the city, I think what needs to happen is it has to build a community. It's community-based, and you have to get the residents involved. I think where City Hall gets all the people that don't live in the city to plan things out and how they feel it should be, they don't do as much as getting the people that live in those areas involved. And sometimes it takes door-to-door type of things. That's what, in Charles House Neighbors in Action, we do a lot of door-to-door stuff. And we tell people, hey, if you can't make it to the meeting, we'll get you the information, but we want your input. And I don't think that the city does a bad job at trying to get people involved, but they stop when people don't get involved. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big issue.
Do you get the sense there are people in the suburbs who love to say, hey, this is what the city should be doing here, here, and here?
Exactly.
Yes?
Exactly. And I mean, they don't understand the dynamics of the neighborhood. Some neighborhoods have a lot of elderly that can't afford to move. Not that they want to move, but they can't afford to move, and they can't get to the assets that they will need. You know, some people see corner stores as a problem. They can be a problem, but they're also an asset to the community. And there's where a lot of people who live in the suburbs don't understand those dynamics. They feel, hey, I'm going to jump in my car, I'm going to drive to Wegmans and take care of what I got to take care of. And some people in the city can't afford to do that.
Yeah. Eugenio, on the same lines then, what's one of the things that people who don't live in the city might get wrong or might have a misconception about? We just heard a couple from Lewis.
Well, I think that it's what you get from the news. It's that barrier of how different things are in the city versus how they are.
You mean a nightly newscast, commercial television news, stabbings every night, those
right.
kind of things.
Right, yeah. And that is not the reality that we live. There are challenges, and you know we will admit to that. But challenges that are consequence of other things that are happening in the neighborhood. For example, a healthy neighborhood in the generic, from the generic perspective, is one where your child can go out from the house and into the neighborhood without being fearful, where the home is clean, that you don't have any rodents or things around, where you're not listening to gunshots and those things. So that's the kind of neighborhood. The kind of health that we want to have for our neighborhoods, and I don't think that in all the people that don't live in the neighborhood understand that those little things are issues, big issues in some of our neighborhood. So that's where a little bit of the disconnect. I think that we all get it in terms of how we should live, but how far we are from that bar that is the standard for everybody, that's where we get into trouble.
Yeah, and so just a sort of a brief diversion in the discussion, because I think we're at an important little juncture here. And a reminder to our audience, if you're just joining us, we're spending the hour talking about what revitalization means in various neighborhoods around our city and what is actually happening right now. Not some of the myths out there, but the reality of what's happening now, neighborhood to neighborhood, with some of the leaders in these communities and these communities within our community. But on the question of the news, let me do two things. Let me play devil's advocate a bit here, because our listeners know I spent 11 years in Rochester on commercial television news, and I know on a nightly basis you often see 20 to 40 second stories, quick hitting, stabbing here, non-fatal shooting here, without a whole lot of context. You don't know if crime's going up or down, you don't know the circumstances, and if that's all you see, if that's the only news consumption you get, you probably do think that our city is in constant turmoil and violence. So I take that point. However, are there neighborhoods where kids fear going outside? Like you just said, yes. Eugenio, we do want a city, no matter the neighborhood. I don't care if it's Beechwood, 19th, where, pick a part of the city. You want kids to be able to go outside and play and not be scared and to not listen to gunshots. And I don't want to stereotype. I don't want to play the game of context-free news and reporting. But is that a problem in a number of places in our city still?
It is a problem. It is a problem. When we started working on in the Clifford County area, we developed a corner park that used to be a parking lot. And when we got there, the parents will not let the children walk their neighborhood to go to the school. They wouldn't let them walk to the store. We got in. And based on what the neighbors wanted, there's no hierarchy here. That we don't come in and tell the neighbors what they want.
You come in and listen.
We come and say, you know, listen, what's your problem? Mm-hmm. We do come in with some preconceived notions that we understand, but we found out that by letting the neighbors state their problems, we found out that, you know, we were not on the same page necessarily.
I think we
recognized the same problems, but in terms of hierarchy, which was most important to them, you know, we were not on the same page. And so we started working in the neighborhood. We started organizing the neighbors. We together with the neighbors and many stakeholders, which is a key thing. You can't do it alone. You need to get support from other stakeholders in the neighborhood, and we've had great partners in doing what we're doing, but the neighbors are still in charge. So after working on developing a park and with the Genesee Land Trust and working on the El Camino Trail, which is a great asset to this city and this state, we have the kids come to the neighborhood to the park and play, and they can go to the corner stores and it's change, and those things are different from what we had before, but we did have the challenges of the guns and all those things, but you have to be consistent and persistent in doing this thing. This didn't happen overnight.
Okay.
And it's not going to go away overnight.
No, and I see Lewis nodding as well. Let me ask both of you then, because when you say you went from those moments where parents didn't want their kids walking to school, you didn't want your kids walking the neighborhood, to a change in safety and change in community mindset, and you say you've got more people to buy in, but how? You know, it's one thing to say, well, the neighbors got involved, they wanted to get involved, but what do you do exactly?
Well, you go ahead, Lewis.
I would like to add, I would say,
yeah, Lewis.
Consistency. See, you know, there's money people fill out for grants all over the country. And they fill out for grants, and they'll come with this new idea, and they'll go door to door, and then they never see them again. So
you're saying there's a grant?
People get grants for all kinds of things.
And it funds something and it doesn't last.
Right. Okay. And it's something that people in poor neighborhoods are like, here comes someone else. They're either going to try to sell me something or buy into something, and then they're gone. And we never see the product. We never see what their goal was. And something with us at Charles House is the fact that we never went away. It's kind of like Iberro's history and Charles Settlement House's history. People like the fact that they know no matter what, tomorrow Iberro's going to have the lights on and Charles Settlement House is going to have the lights on. Some people come with false profits into the neighborhoods and hurt the people that are really trying to do good things. And, you know, the Josanna neighborhood for eons was always called Ghost Town. And there's reason for it. The gangs were called ghost town, everything else that was negative followed that. With the help of Charles Settlement House and Charles House Neighbors in Action, we got the school district and the city to work together. We got a $2.2 million gym that wasn't even the plan for the new making of School 17 done so it could be used at the community center. So children in the neighborhood had somewhere safe to go. Safety plays a major role. And we're not going to get kids out of their homes or parents out of their homes if they feel unsafe. And I think, you know, that's no big secret. But it's something that in order to build neighborhoods, people need to feel safe, need to be able to sit on their front porch and things of that sort. If we're not able to do that, we're never going to be able to resolve this because there's good people in bad neighborhoods.
What Lewis is saying, it applies across so many different genres of government, of debate about policy, mm-hmm. even among the well-intended.
Right.
Let's say a county, maybe Monroe County, has a structural fiscal problem. You can try one-shot measures to fix it, or you can do the hard work of a long-term fix. And what Lewis is saying, even the grants, if the people who come into these neighborhoods with really good intentions, they probably do have very good intentions, right?
Right, right.
But they're in and then they're gone.
Exactly.
You need a long-term fix. The people who will be there, the people involved being there. Eugenio, you want to add to that as well?
Yeah, I want to. I agree with Lewis. You have to be persistent and you have to be committed. We have great partners. I'm going to mention the Greater Rochester Health Foundation. They have engaged with us for the long haul, and they are very committed. Talking about partnerships, this is the type of partners that you want to have because they are pliable, if I may. They experiment the changes with you and react to those changes. So you're not in a box in a straight jacket. You got to do A, B, and C. No, you work with the changes in the neighborhood and react to them to be able to get to the goals that you want to get. And the Ibero-American Development Corporation and Ibero, we have invested a lot of dollars in the neighborhood. But most importantly, it's not what you invest monetarily. It's how you empower the neighbors. I mean, you can make the neighborhood as pretty as you want, but if you don't organize the neighbors and they don't take ownership of where they live, beyond their boundaries of their house, then you're not going to go anywhere. And that's what we are purposely trying to promote in that neighborhood.
And Scott mentioned, Josana, you create a plan, and you said that involved working with city government, right?
Sure.
Going how far back?
Well, the detailed plan was put together in 2010 and finally approved in early 2011. And it was actually... for a few years, we had started, I would say, reorganizing and getting some things happening in the neighborhood with a program very similar to what Ibero has with the Health Foundation and so on. And Habitat for Humanity had begun to build some houses in the neighborhood in scattered site style. And at some point, the city said, if we don't have a plan for this neighborhood, we shouldn't just continue to build these wherever we'd have a vacant lot. And the residents did a couple of things. One, they came together and supported Habitat. Don't stop them from building, but yes, we agree there ought to be a more comprehensive plan for where we're going as a neighborhood. So Habitat continued to build while in the year the plan was developed, but we looked at everything from safety to the school that was in the neighborhood, human services, how to get people involved in more activities in the neighborhood, additional housing. All in all, there were over 60 recommendations that came out of it. And as I look back at this 150-page plan, we actually have, I would say, at least addressed in one form or another at least 50 of the 60 recommendations. And it doesn't mean everything is complete, but a lot of things are moving forward. And I give you a great example. Lewis alluded to School 17, the Enrico Fermi Elementary School on Orchard Street. That school had been envisioned to really be, in essence, the center of an urban village, being the Josanna neighborhood. And it had gone from being a neighborhood school to where only about 40% of the kids are from the neighborhood. The modernization program for the school district came along, and it was in phase one, except the original plan, because there were just set guidelines, elementary schools were not going to get gymnasiums and things like that. So they were basically going to, you know, fix up the building, put some new technology in it. Except that building had been built with a gym on the second floor in the middle of the building, which meant at 3 o'clock when school was over, the use of the building was over, because there was no way to let the community use the building without having the whole thing wide open. So we actually, the residents got real involved in this and got elected officials from the city and elected officials from the school district and then the administrations of both to sit down and say, you know, you may be penny wise, but this is pound foolish. And the overall budget did go up $2 or $3 million. But what we ended up with instead was not only a modern facility for the daytime learning, but the new gym, cafeteria, band rooms, and community rooms were built on as an addition. Now the City Rec Center operates a program in the school beginning at 5 o'clock at night through the entire school year. We're working on something called the Center for Continuous Learning, which is where some other organizations come in and offer workshops, classes, speakers, and things. It's possible just because the design of the building was changed to make it feasible to do that. So those are the kinds of things that if you have a plan that in this case said the school ought to be the center of the village, now something comes along and you're going to modernize it, well then let's make sure that the modernization happens the way the plan envisions.
And you went from, you said it was a second floor gymnasium, is that right?
Yeah.
That was essentially 3 o'clock every afternoon, not really usable, to now something that is staffed, run?
Staffed with the rec center during the school year.
How much
and
use is it
getting? Throughout the year. I mean, dozens of kids are there all the time, and we've, you know, use it for other events, whether it's, you know, one of the neighborhood churches puts on a big health fair and Thanksgiving dinner in November that they couldn't house in their own church. Again, it's something that's a neighborhood-based sort of thing, but the school building becomes the ideal location. So it really is developing into being the center of the neighborhood. It has a long way to go, but the, you know, in the last 2 years since that construction was finished, that's the direction we're moving.
This plan, 160 pages or so, the real development started 5 years ago, and that would have been, Tom Richards was mayor? I'm trying to remember who was that Bob Duffy? Tom
yeah, it Richards? Might have been, I'm trying to remember if when the plan started, the end of Bob Duffy,
so this is going across administrations, though.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And we're still working now with
And that
with
hasn't
Mayor
been a
Warren.
Problem.
No, the faces change, and sometimes you have to build new relationships, mm-hmm. but the plan hasn't been abandoned in any way. I mean, there are tweaks here and there, but we've moved forward.
We're talking about revitalizing different city neighborhoods and what that means. And Scott, just following up on some of those points there, Sarah emailed this morning and said, if you're going to talk about this, please ask about gentrification. It seems like no one's concerned about it, and they should be. I'm sure no, it's not true that no one's concerned about it. But to Sarah's question, let's go around the table. How do you feel about it?
Well, I think gentrification, when it's taken in the traditional sense of it's just we're just going to displace who's there because now everything that goes in is going to be of in a way that it's going to push people out, I absolutely don't want to see that happen. I mean, I think when you create a healthier neighborhood, you are going to bring other investment in that may bring other people that wouldn't have considered moving into the neighborhood. But wholesale, oh, we're just going to turn this from, you know, blocks of vacant buildings, and now it's all going to be, you know, market rate or high-end luxury, this and that. No, I absolutely don't want to see that. And I think Josanna has been a good example of where, you know, we're building, besides Habitat, the Stadium Estates affordable housing project is well underway. We're past the halfway point in terms of occupancy at this point of 45 units. And we just got some preliminary assessment data that shows the overall neighborhood for the first time in years. Assessments in that neighborhood have been going down for years. They're up, I want to say, between 1% and 5%. So it means the person that owns their house there, it's not like all of a sudden their taxes are going to go through the roof. But for the first time in years and years, there's actually more value in their house this year than there was 5 years ago.
I'm looking at the Stadium Estates project summary here. So again, 45 units located on city-owned vacant lots scattered throughout the neighborhood, right? And 14 single-family houses, 11 duplexes, 3 triplexes, rents ranging from $600 for a 3-bedroom unit to $785 for a 5-bedroom unit.
Yes.
All right there. And what's the short description on the mission of the Stadium Estates housing?
Well, it is affordable because it's financed through tax credit financing and some other sources. So you're able to offer brand new, beautiful, energy efficient housing as rental. It could be sold as individual homes after the tax credit compliance runs out in 15 years. But you're getting extremely high quality homes replacing either empty lots or houses that had to be torn down to make room for it.
And not the kind of housing that would be unsustainable long-term for families to live in. If you think it's modest, it's doable.
Yeah, the square footage of the rooms, I mean, you know, you look at a bedroom and it may be, I'll say like a 9x11 or, 9x12, depending on what it is. So these are not big, spacious buildings, but they're extremely well built. Energy Star, all sorts of high energy things to make it affordable. And one piece that I'll say, and this is where listening to the neighbors, when we were talking about housing, people said, we're one of the few neighborhoods that doesn't have a project in terms of housing. And we don't want a project to come in. So this is scattered.
No, I think the word project has become a pejorative.
Yes. And what we did, and we worked very closely with the developer, Charles Settlement House is the nonprofit partner with Rochester's Cornerstone Group on this, and we worked with the architects and engineers and created different looks for these houses and different facades and different colors. So even when you have two or three of them on the same block, if you look down the street right now, it doesn't look like they're all just the same house plopped on every other corner. We literally came up with 6 different design packages out of these 28 buildings so that no two are exactly alike.
See, that's a little thing that's a big thing. That's what you've learned from history and the way
yes.
people respond to these kind of projects. It is
yes.
a project. But yes. And
now it doesn't look like what they perceive as a project.
All right, I'm late for a break. I want to get a short break. We're going to continue the discussion. Some of our listeners have asked about housing, and we've been talking about that for a number of weeks. I think that's a big piece of the puzzle in reinventing and revitalizing neighborhoods. And maybe reinvent's the wrong term. We don't want to reinvent the neighborhood. We want to strengthen our neighborhoods. And our guests for the hour are helping us through that. You just heard Scott Benjamin from the Charles Settlement House. Eugenio Marlin is the president, He is the vice president in charge of the Ibero-American Development Corporation. Luis Aponte, president of Charles House Neighbors in Action. And in a second, we're going to be joined by George Moses, the executive director of Northeast Area Development. If you want to join the conversation, you can. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. The conversation continues in less than a minute on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a New York State Constitutional Convention. The last one that was held was 1967. 2017 would mark 50 years, and it would mark the next opportunity for voters in this state to do the same. So what would a constitutional convention look like, and what could it achieve? Lots of questions around this, and we'll get them answered for you next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to listen to what Rochester Mayor's lovely Warren said on the question of housing on this program. And again, this is a theme we keep revisiting, and we're going to continue to do that because I think it's important. It's important to understand not only our history, but where we're going when we talk about revitalizing neighborhoods, what we do about a concentration of poverty. We know from the Rochester Area Community Foundation and the report compiled by Ed Doherty, among others, that Rochester not only has the highest level of poverty for a city of its size in the nation, we have the highest level of concentrated poverty. and extreme poverty. That means people living at 50% or below of the poverty line, and more than half of Rochester's children living in poverty. So the question becomes, what do you do with it? And again, this is, you know, I'm going back to Luis's comments. It's easy from the people from the outside to say, well, you know, break it up, move them around. We need more suburbs to step up. Rochester's Mayor Lovely Warren on this program last week talked about what the neighborhoods have expressed that they want.
One of the things that the poverty report has outlined is that people don't necessarily want to move outside of their neighborhood. They want to remain there. They just want their neighborhood uplifted. And for many years, we have had this discussion about shifting people from one neighborhood to another. That doesn't get to the root cause.
Okay. I saw a lot of nods around the table. Anybody disagree with what you just heard? No? Let me bring in George Moses from Northeast Area Development. What do you think you just heard?
Well, I heard what I believe is a true statement. And I'm excited to see some of the dialogue is changing, because we talk about what I call tough conversations, because we start to talk about gentrification. And one of the things we have to do is we have to have conversations about it. We cannot be afraid of, well, what does it actually mean? What does gentrification mean? What does mixed income communities mean? Who actually wants to stay in a poor community? What does that mean? So when the mayor talks about a lot of folks who want to stay in their neighborhood, she's correct. I'm actually one of them. I'm blessed to actually work and live in my service area. And that's
which is where, George?
It's in 14609. I live on Parcells Avenue. So that's actually a service area in Beechwood. And Beechwood is a lovely place. We have lots of great trees. I'm a tree person. I'm a grass person. And we have lots of things that are going on as we talk about reinventing what is going on. It's just we're redoing some things that are old things, doing them again, kind of spinning them to what is
Freedom
new.
Market?
Freedom Market is one of the many things we're doing as you talk about economic development. Because when there's so many issues. As you're talking about poverty, generally what they do is you just move it around. You actually, how you deconcentrate is you just move folks here and move folks there. We're looking at things different. How can we increase the wealth of people who are there? Those who want to stay, those who stayed through the tough times. And they said, you know what? I'm going to really stay in here and I see what the potential is in my neighborhood. And I've heard about gentrification, but I'm going to stay. What are some protections for those folks who choose to stay? And then how do we welcome some of those folks back who have left because they couldn't stay? Because we have to build a balance to those who want to come back to the mm-hmm. neighborhoods. I see a lot of folks who have come from, I used to live in Beechwood. I used to live in Beechwood. I used to stay on Culver. And for some reason or another, they have left, but it's a beautiful neighborhood.
Now, before I get to the phones, Julie, we're coming to you in just a second. But I want to continue on what I think is an important part of this conversation on the concentration of poverty. And let me ask a very ignorant question. And I'll ask it, Luis. Luis has talked about the people who have really good intentions but don't live in the city. I don't live in the city. But I think about what the people who wrote that report on poverty have said, which is that we have chosen over the years through our policy and where we've built affordable housing projects, whatever you want to call them, and we've concentrated poverty. It's been a community choice, and it goes back decades now. It goes back a generation or two. And part of, George, I think about this and I think, okay, if we have concentrated poverty, doesn't that make it more difficult for the people living in those neighborhoods to get out of poverty? I'm not saying to move them, but I'm saying if they stay there, is it harder for those neighborhoods to succeed, meaning attract new jobs, meaning have the transportation necessary to get to work, meaning have the social services you need to raise kids, especially if you're a single mom, those kind of things. If you are in a block of concentrated poverty, doesn't that have less of a chance than if we did, not that we just could, but if we did move poverty around, as we said, and more of our areas in the city and in the suburbs took more of sort of an equal share and we all lived together and worked together, is it harder if the poverty is concentrated? George?
Well, if you're in any area that is resource poor, you're going to have some challenges. So I think you got to ask different questions. How do we actually, it's almost like the school conversation. How do we make the schools we have better instead of just moving the children around? Because at some point, you're still going to have to deal with the tough question of how do we make these neighborhoods better? And it also comes from an assumption of, I believe the people who live there have the ideas how to make their community better. And as I was listening, I heard Lewis say something about there are well-meaning people who come in and want to do things. What we have to do is be able to have coordination, that they have to work with those who are there. Because you don't just say we don't need help. Everyone needs some sort of help in different ways. But how do you coordinate the help of those who want to help, and what help do they need?
All right, so you've seen it. And that's what Eugenio was saying earlier in the hour. It's actually listening to the people instead of just sort of dictating the neighborhoods, which is an important idea. But George, you've seen it. What's an example of the kind of conversations that you have with these stakeholders that has sparked an idea that's led to some change that you've seen?
Well, I've seen a couple of them. And as Eugenio has said and Lewis has said, they talked a lot about the 14621 neighborhood also. I'm also the executive director for Group 14621 Community Association. So I've had the benefit of seeing the 14621 neighborhood and the 14609 neighborhood, two very similar but very distinct neighborhoods, and how they're going about development. And if you look at those neighborhoods there, you would say, wow, how do those two neighborhoods go together? But the people are the same in terms of what they want, in terms of aspirations. So I've seen, and 14621, as Eugenio said earlier, when they talked about the El Camino Park, I watched what Nurse Bowick did on the corner. She brought in other resources like the Greater Rochester Health Foundation, like Rochester Area Community Foundation, and they put people. They put the people who live on that neighborhood on that trail. And they put a lot of folks who love what was happening from outside of the city on that trail to see for themselves, oh, wait a minute, this is actually a great thing going on. So you get past what you said earlier, those 40-second snippets that go on. I've seen in the Beachwood area, we've heard a lot about corner stores and how they're a deficit to neighborhoods. We know for fact that you can actually change a corner store around and make it an asset in your neighborhood. Not just a food asset, but an economic asset.
You did it.
We did it. So there's a lot of these things that we're doing, and we're actually working now with, as we talk about housing, with a developer in home leasing, in terms of we're doing a whole East Main development right now. Very interesting. We're going through some very tough conversations. We're having direct conversations about gentrification, direct conversations about mixed income neighborhoods, direct conversations about how do we support the mom and pop businesses while we balance and the others, like if we want to bring a major franchise. And we actually have another franchise opportunity that's going to be starting very soon with the Salvatore's family brand on Webster Avenue. So we're looking for one thing to spark the next thing, because we're looking to add what's called a speedy slice, not just adding jobs, but adding the opportunity for someone in the neighborhood, a veteran, to come back to the neighborhood and own. And that person can create jobs. So I'm coming from a different perspective where I'm actually very excited because I'm seeing the things that are going on. I watch the news, but I don't let the news necessarily define how I know what's going on in the neighborhood. My children still go to neighborhood schools, but I also have a daughter who goes urban suburban. So they're getting different experiences, and I see the differences in, oh, okay, not that I'm going to be envious of what someone else is doing. I said, well, how can we make this what we're doing here better? So those who live in impoverished neighborhoods are resource poor. What do we do? How do we get these additional resources? And as Eugenio said, we've been very blessed with a lot of other funders who have come in, the Rochester Community Foundation, Greater Rochester Health Foundation, the Farish Foundation, the City of Rochester, who are saying, what do you guys need? How can we support you?
Now, I've got to get to the phones. Julie's been waiting. She wants to continue the conversation on some housing and some properties. Go ahead, Julie.
Hi. Yes, I am calling actually as a member of Take Back the Land Rochester. And this is a very important conversation. I'm going to add one other aspect to it, which is, you know, we hear a lot about zombie homes and what to do to keep them from deteriorating. And we hear talk about requiring the banks that own those homes to keep them in good shape. But we don't hear a lot about ways to actually keep those homes from becoming vacant in the first place. And I think the most important thing is to not grow more vacancies. So in order for neighborhoods to feel the power they need to vitalize their neighborhoods, the city needs to work with homeowners who are in danger of losing their homes from unconscionable bank practices. The more vacant homes a street suffers as a result, the more powerless people feel. The city needs to join people like Senator Elizabeth Warren in demanding that FHA HUD stop incentivizing banks to force vacancies in order for them to collect FHA insurance. If HUD changes and makes it possible for homeowners to continue to negotiate ways to stay in their homes, even after foreclosure, it'll encourage banks to actually work with those homeowners rather than cause more vacant homes. And finally, if the city itself were to put a lower priority on police enforcement of court-ordered foreclosure evictions, it would force the banks to work with these homeowners to come up with solutions rather than add another empty house in the neighborhood.
Julie, thanks for your comments. So let's see what the panel has to say about that. And Eugenio?
Yes, I agree with her. A lot of prevention will help the city a lot if, in terms of housing. But let me touch on gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
You can't control gentrification unless you manage it. We will continue to work in these neighborhoods and make housing better, and hopefully the surrounding properties will also become better properties, and as that comes, they'll become more desirable, and the prices, the cost of the will go up. So you know, there's a process of gentrification that is natural. Now, there has to be a plan by the municipality to manage it in such a way so that those changes are not detrimental in the long run to the community by displacing the people that live there.
How do you manage it?
Well, I've heard that some municipalities have dealt with the taxes, and there's some formulas that they use to make sure that people are not put in a position where they can't afford the taxes on their houses, you know, after the prices go up, and so seniors don't have to leave the neighborhood. But it has to be managed. It's there. It's going to happen. You know. You work in the neighborhood. We work on the Huntington Park neighborhood, and there are some nice little mansions up there. As you get them in better shape, people will want to move in there. The desirable place, you know, and you go through that. But in the end, you start getting the displacement of the people that have been there that don't want to move. So it's a real problem that has to be managed. You know, just saying that it's not going to happen, it's not going to change it. It has to be managed.
Okay. Stephen on Twitter says, how can we be effective allies for communities struggling with poverty? And I take this as to say, it sounds like he's saying, I don't live in one of these neighborhoods, but I want help. My mind goes back to the conversations that have been happening in the city in the last 18 months or so, the debate about do suburbanites need to, quote unquote, stay in their lane, or is there a way for us all to be involved, even if we don't live there? What would you say?
I would say, excuse me, there is a way for everyone to be involved as long as you listen to the people that live there first. I think that when we were doing the master plan for the Josanna area, the first thing one of the neighbors were concerned about is they're going to put this beautiful house next to my house that I haven't been able to update, that I haven't been able to afford to do things. I need a roof. Now people are going to look at this house and see that I need a roof and I need a front porch. And we came together with the builders and with the city of Rochester and told them, look, how can we get these folks grants, or could we get them some help, whether it's fencing, whether it's things of that sort. And between the builders and the city, they came to an agreement, and mainly the builders went the extra miles, what I would say. And people don't want to leave their neighborhood. Some do, of course. Everybody wants to live on Park Avenue, wants to live out in the suburb where their kids can run and play and do whatever. But a lot of people want to stay there. They just don't want to live their home to look like a wreck next to this new, beautiful home. How are you going to help me knowing that I'm in poverty and can't afford to put new siding or windows and things in my house? So people are looking for the city to step up and help them, not give it to them, but show them that they're going to help them do something. And that was a big topic conversation that took over one of the meetings, where people said, this is what we envision. We asked them, how do you envision the neighborhood to be? If we were going to put all these houses, where would you put them? And how would you want the neighborhood to look? And that was very important. The builders and the architects did a great job with that, because they sat down and didn't give input. They said, you tell us how you want it to look. And that was very important to them. And there's where our numbers and our membership grew and grew and grew, because they felt they were being listened to. We even got some of the mom and pop grocery store owners to come in and give their input. And we got some of them to stop selling cigarettes, stop selling liquor, stop doing all of that kind of stuff, put fresh vegetables in there, and even donate to the community picnic. And I mean, in the sums of $500, $600 each year. So, you know, it's about buy-in. And people have to know that everything that you're trying to do is sustainable, that you're not going to get shot down by the city when you ask for a couple thousand dollars and you're just going to go away, that you're going to keep on fighting, keep on the good fight. Well, so I think that's important.
It sounds like what Eugenio was talking about when you talk about managing gentrification.
Right.
That sounds like, you know, when Lewis was talking about the neighbor who's worried that if you just pop something next door that looks like a palace and it does everything wrong to our property and doesn't fit, that's kind of what it sounds like, managing it wisely. Yeah?
Yes, because the new things become more desirable. But let me go back to the gentleman that how can you know,
how can we help? Sure.
How
yep.
can we help? I think first thing is, you know, and it's obvious by the question, that is to recognize that we own the problem collectively.
Mm-hmm.
The little problem in the city is the problem of the total city and the suburbs surrounding the city. And I think that your interest in the neighborhood, for example, on November the 7th, we're going to have a charrette for the area in which we work. That's not exclusive to the people that live there. They will be the ones having the great input. But for someone from the outside to come and participate, you get an idea of the needs and how you can help from the outside, respecting the desires of the people in the neighborhood. So I think we collectively own it, and it's not just my problem, it's your problem too.
Tim emails the program and says, Evan, great program, much needed discussion. The 2010 Josana Comprehensive Plan is an exceptionally well-conceived plan. Your guests are to be congratulated, but he says he fears it will never be accomplished due to the massive expense involved. What do you make of that?
Well, there is a lot of expense, but it actually is being implemented. You know, those first 45 units of housing, I think 28 are occupied. They'll all be done by the end of December. Habitat for Humanity continues to build in the neighborhood. Some of it is just as you do projects that would happen naturally to incorporate the plan. And I'll give you an example. This past summer, it was time just for the routine milling and paving of J Street, which is a major corridor right through that neighborhood. One of the things in the plan is that the street should, in that section as it goes through that part of the neighborhood, should continue to revert to primarily residential. You know, there are some stores on it and so on, but let that natural evolution occur. And because the street was built at a time when there was more commercial, it's wider. So what do you do to calm traffic? Well, just as part of the normal reconstruction of that road, they went ahead, added the bicycle lane on one side, did some special stenciled crosswalks, changed a few things, which now gives the illusion of a little bit narrower street, and the studies show that naturally slows people down on the street. And the work needed to be done. It was just incorporating some of these other elements. So it's not that we're going to be all, you know, 2 years, everything is done, but it's an incremental phased approach. The one thing I would also say when we were talking about what people can do, I mean, it's not that volunteers and getting involved by suburbanites is not a good thing. It's a great thing if they're in it for the long haul and listen to the people that are living there. But I also think that we have a lot of government policies that get developed, and I call it the law of unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. Stadium Estates, one of those, because of the way tax credit financing is done, in an effort to make sure that you're not discriminating against who moves into those houses, you also aren't allowed to give preference to the people already living in the neighborhood or something like that. So there's a policy decision that means everybody that wanted to apply had to go into a lottery, and we actually had to market to the people that lived that were least likely to move there. And the way the regulations are written, that's to show that it's out there and it's not just going to be, I'm going to build a house for my brother-in-law.
Kind of backwards, though?
But it has that unintended consequence of we couldn't give any preference to people already living in that area. Mm-hmm. I think every time, you know, and I don't mind saying I'm a suburbanite because I moved to Monroe County 25 years ago and I haven't moved in 24 years. So I make sure I'm trying to let the residents take the lead on this sort of thing. But when I look in my own area, I see the farm fields that continually get turned into new housing developments. Every time we extend the water lines, extend the sewer lines, and widen the highways, we make it easier and cheaper to buy new someplace else, and then get mad at the people in where we already had infrastructure that have trouble affording it. And I just think, so if you're thinking in the broader context, those kinds of policy decisions are things that voters in the suburbs should think about as well.
We've evaporated the hour, and I feel like we needed two or three. But let's do this. For our listeners who want to see more, maybe read the plan and those kind of things, and check out more about these associations and these efforts, we will link, when we post this podcast to wxxinews.org/connections, we'll throw some links up there, and you can check out more if you want to get involved, no matter where you live. And I hope all of our guests will come back and continue these conversations, because this was not nearly enough time, gentlemen. Thank you for all of your efforts in revitalizing our communities. Take a short break, and we're talking constitutional conventions.